from deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, not just from the Le Chaux Dome, from the newly opened post-op lounge of the Le Chaux Dome. I didn't know it had one either, but I'm definitely in the post-op lounge today because the host of this program underwent minor shoulder surgery this week, and so I got to join the Jerry Lewis Chevy Chase Club for moments, if you know what I mean. It's woozy in here, but so we're in the post-op lounge. It's a show very light, shall we say, on production values, because normally, you know, it takes two hands to run a radio broadcast. Today, maybe one and a half. We'll see. And also, it's occurred to me that one of the known side effects of this particular medication is a tendency to play a lot of cuts from your recently released CD. So that's going to be happening today as well. But first, ladies and gentlemen, the newfound prominence of the words "I don't know." It amazes me. It always amazes me the degree to which people who run our news operations, both the executives and the front people, seem to have all of the attention deficit disorder that they blame us for having. So it was, that this week our defense secretary, Robert Gates, had an interview with New York Times columnist David Brooks. And when he was asked if the invasion of Iraq was worth doing, Gates said, quote, "If I'd known then what I know now, would I have done the same? I think the answer is, I don't know," unquote. And it was up to you and me to remember all the way back to the week before. Because I don't think any story that I saw about Gates's interview brought this up. But it was just way back the week before that General Petraeus, said when he was asked in his one of his appearances before either the House or the Senate whether the Iraq War has made us safer, his reply was, "I don't know." So apparently that's the new party line now, is "I don't know." So let's keep it up, because I don't know. But don't ask me, I don't know. Ladies and gentlemen, the other thing worth considering here at the start, another story where a dot was left unconnected, was this very mysterious story that's been sort of sniveling its way through the media for the last couple weeks. The story about an Israeli attack on Syria on September 6th of this year. And as you know, if you saw the president's, he's still the president, isn't that something? President's news conference this week, it's something he's not going to discuss or comment on in any way. But there have been rumors about what that attack was, if it was. And the most prominent of them, of course, have been that there was some sort of a suspected nuclear thing that the Syrians had set up in some sort of suspected collaboration with North Korea. The latest information about it came from the Washington Post on Friday, which said that Israel's decision to attack Syria came after Israel shared intelligence with President Bush. Well, that's a good idea. He could use some. That North Korean nuclear personnel were in Syria. Now, that's interesting intelligence, but it sort of begs the question, North Korean nuclear personnel. Who was it that taught the North Koreans? Who was it that sent, sold, and gave information to the North Koreans about how to do this stuff so they could come share it with the Syrians? Where'd the North Koreans get their nuclear know-how from? Yes, you do know. Pakistan. That was the program of proliferation run by General A.Q. Khan, the father of the Pakistan bomb, when the proliferation ring was broken up after having revealed that he gave or sold nuclear know-how and materials to North Korea, Libya, and Iran. He was subjected to house arrest. A bad old house arrest. Anyway, Syria and North Korea both denied they're cooperating on a nuclear program, but the word Pakistan didn't appear anywhere in any of the stories about this mysterious attack. Pakistan, by the way, the country where they're going to have a democratic election, I think, early next month, and in honor of that election, the president, also the head of the armed forces, which, of course, is against the Pakistani constitution, to be both, is celebrating by today arresting leaders of the opposition party. It's, you know, it's a different form of democracy. It's a spicier form of democracy. Hello, welcome to the show.
Well, come on, let's go for a trip. That'll be a real gas. Country some class. It'll be a great ride, and you can't beat the pride. We'll be American guys on Mars. The planet is
Mars.
Red.
Go to Mars, baby. Let's go to
but
Mars.
It may not be dead.
Mars, go to Mars, baby. Let's go.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer welcoming you to this attenuated edition of the show. I'm attenuated. I don't know about you. I'm gimped up or limped down. I'm half-shouldered. I'm demi-shouldered. I had minor shoulder surgery. Don't worry about it. Don't send me anything. No fruit baskets, please. Thank you. Thank you very much. boy, in the department of strange memory joggers to have to deal with, I now am reminded also of the stunt pulled off this morning, Sunday morning, as you're hearing this, as I'm saying this, by Hillary Clinton, candidate for president. We still have president in this country. She appeared on all five Sunday morning talk shows this week, just one after another. And it was a stunt that I believe was pioneered by a man who at one time had given his name to the stunt. Of course, time passes. We're busy remembering the OJ stuff this week. Hey, who, by the way, who dreamed that the sports collectible world was so classy? But so we're busy remembering the OJ names, and so we've forgotten some of these other names. But it was the first guy, check me if I'm wrong, the first guy to do all five Sunday morning talk shows was Monica Lewinsky's attorney. It's just a weird association for Hillary to want to leave in some furtive part of the public imagination at this point in time. I'm sure they didn't know. I'm sure they didn't notice. I'm sure they didn't remember. Well, I'm sure the medication is wearing off. Ladies and gentlemen, accountability is a bitch. So you got to jimmy it just a little bit. In the weeks before key government tests of new radiation detection equipment, this is just about radiation detection. Don't get your knickers in a twist. Officials at the Department of Homeland Security helped contractors do repeated dry runs that enabled them to perform better during the tests. This is according to documents obtained by the Washington Post late in the week. This is the same way we test missile defense. Now, here's where the missile is going to be coming from, and here's where it's going to be going, and here's when it's going to be launched. Go get it. Congress had been awaiting the test results before deciding whether to move forward on this troubled $1.5 billion counterterrorism effort to deploy radiation detectors just at ports and where else? Where else would you think? Ports and border crossings, that's right. To screen trucks, cars, and cargo carriers for nuclear devices. That's all. No biggie. The project has been delayed for months over concerns that department officials earlier misled Congress about the effectiveness of the test devices, known as Advanced Spectroscopic Portals, or ASPs. The Government Accountability Office is telling members of Congress that new test results cannot be relied upon because the department's Domestic Nuclear Detection Office allowed contractors to collect test data about the kinds of radioactive materials they would be screening and then to adjust their systems accordingly. In other words, cheat, basically. Basically just cheat. It's the No Contractor Left Behind program. Almost all the materials and combinations of materials that were used in the formal tests were identical to those that the contractors had specifically set their ASPs to identify from dry runs and dress rehearsals, said the Government Accountability Office. Said a Democratic congressman, Homeland Security's handling of this issue would be comical if the threat of nuclear terror wasn't so real. Well, maybe it's not. Maybe that's what they're hiding. It's the fact that it's not. In a statement, Russ Knocke, spokesperson for the Homeland Security Department, defended the department's handling, saying, quote, dry runs are a smart and common practice for testing programs and test technologies prior to live use. ASP systems will have been subjected to the most rigorous and comprehensive evaluation of any radiation detection equipment ever deployed by the U.S. government, Knocke said. The department has put forward a prudent approach to testing a system that is very much needed and is already showing promise of considerable improvements. Hundreds of detectors have been deployed at a cost of more than $200 million, but those machines often cannot distinguish nuclear devices from benign sources of radiation such as cat litter. Threats getting worse all the time, ladies and gentlemen. Cat litter. Homeland Security officials say a new generation of far more costly machines offer the potential of reducing false cat litter alarms. The GAO questioned that assertion last year. The Nuclear Detection Office gave Congress a report that asserted that $377,000 machines would detect highly enriched uranium 95% of the time. And 2 weeks later, they announced the award of $1.5 billion worth of contracts for the new machines. The next month, the GAO notified lawmakers that that claim of 95% accuracy was only an assumption. And you know what happens when you assume. Actual Homeland Security tests from 2005 showed the detection rate was far lower, according to the Washington Post. New test results have not been made public, but GAO auditors said the test methods did not provide a fair and balanced, evaluation of the ASP's capabilities. They said the test did not properly assess the machine's ability to detect and identify dangerous radioactive material masked by other benign radioactive material intended to simulate a false alarm. The GAO concluded the test results should not be relied upon to make a full-scale production decision. That's your Department of Homeland Security, ladies and gentlemen. That's the accountability we seek, that we need. The security we depend upon. It's cute. They're giving them the answers. Hey, if it's good enough for missile defense, it's good enough for everything else we do. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
The celebrity website TMZ.com posted a video of Judge Lance Ito. Remember him? Presided over O.J. Simpson's 1995 murder trial. The video declared the former football great guilty of sin at the crimes he's accused of committing in Las Vegas. Except it wasn't Ito. Officials at Los Angeles County Superior Court quickly informed the website about the error. Quote, the video does not depict Judge Ito. He's not in the video. He's not commented in any way to any media organization about the Las Vegas case or any other matter relating to O.J. Simpson, past or present. TMZ.com issued an apology, calling it, quote, a stupid mistake. Also in the realm of television, this is from Stuart Taylor, an editorialist in the Washington Post. I apologize to MSNBC talk show host Joe Scarborough and to the Post for the cutting description of Mr. Scarborough in an op-ed guilty in the Duke case by me and a collaborator about the Duke lacrosse case. I wrote that description on the basis of transcripts of Joe Scarborough's programs early in the Duke case. My attention has since been drawn to transcripts of several subsequent programs, and I realize that Mr. Scarborough was one of a handful of journalists who deserve credit for calling attention early in the case to the emerging evidence of innocence. I am very sorry that because of insufficient research, the op-ed suggested otherwise. Signed, Stuart Taylor. Dateline Irvine, California. The embattled chancellor of the University of California, Irvine, avoided a public rebuke from faculty this week as he apologized for withdrawing an offer to make a liberal legal scholar the founding dean of the university's new law school. Just me taking water. Quote, I've learned a very painful lesson this week. I've made a series of difficult decisions without consulting senior faculty early enough or often enough, says Chancellor Michael V. Drake. I'm sorry for this, and I apologize sincerely for the problems that it caused. And by it, of course, he means him. Drake ignited a nationwide debate about academic freedom last week when he abruptly withdrew the offer from legal scholar Erwin Chemerinsky. Chemerinsky said Drake told him the offer was being withdrawn because he, Chemerinsky, was, quote, too politically controversial, unquote. The chancellor denied he had been pressured to release Chemerinsky. He re-extended the offer, which Chemerinsky accepted on Monday after a private weekend meeting. Mattel, continuing its series of weekly apologies, they've been apologizing for weeks to American toy consumers for crappy toys made in China. Now Mattel is apologizing to the Chinese, acknowledging that Mattel's own design flaws and safety control system, not Chinese manufacturing glitches, were to blame for the recent recalls of more than 20 million toys. Quote, Mattel takes full responsibility for these recalls and apologizes personally to you, the Chinese people. That's going to take a while. And all of our customers who received the toys. This from Mattel Vice President Thomas Dabrowski. Oh, he apologized personally to Li Changjiang, head of China's product safety operation, in a visit to Beijing. Dabrowski admitted Mattel recalled more toys than necessary, and only a small percentage of the recalls were lead paint related. It cleaned out the pipeline, though, didn't it? Just wondering what Mattel's going to apologize for next week and to whom. A PR team attempted to close the Millennium Bridge in London at rush hour and turn it into a sprint track to launch Adidas' commercial partnership with the 2012 Olympic Games. But crucially, the organizers failed to gain permission from the City of London to close the pedestrian bridge, which links the Tate Modern Museum and St. Paul's Cathedral. As two American world champion sprinters took to their marks, angry pedestrians broke through a line of security guards on the north side of the bridge. The guards attempted to restrain the commuters, who insisted that they had right of way. One commuter, Roger Krosky, said, "It was crazy to do that at 10 a.m. when it's going to be so busy." Unquote. The City of London spokesman said, "If people were inconvenienced, then we apologize for that." The famous if-then apology rears its pretty little head one more time. There's an apology in a courtroom relating to O.J. Simpson, and it's not what you think. A court administrator in Las Vegas apologized to lawyers for O.J. Simpson this week after a court employee was caught taking a picture of the former football star during his first court appearance on robbery, kidnapping, and assault charges. Charles Short, the chief executive officer for Clark County, Nevada courts, said a court reporter used a mobile phone camera to snap the picture of Juice as he left the courtroom at the end of Wednesday's hearing. "Our court is a professional organization, and this behavior is an aberration and will not be tolerated," Short wrote in a letter to Simpson's lawyers. The photo was deleted before it could be distributed, and the employee's actions have been addressed in the appropriate way, he wrote. I just want to hang out with the sports collectors. They seem like such classy guys. Nice people doing nice things. And finally, there's a Bush administration apology, but again, it's not what you think. A Bush administration official sent thousands of government employees a newsletter that encouraged them to consider buying fuel-efficient vehicles built in Asia. Joe Ellis has apologized to U.S. automakers and their employees. Ellis is the Department of Health and Human Services Assistant Secretary for Administration and Management. Some domestic automakers and 15 members of Congress from Michigan complained about that August email sent to 67,000 employees of the Department of Health and Human Services, asking them to consider a list of a dozen green cars. All were made by Japanese or Korean automakers. None by, are they still the big three? Well, whatever size three they are in Detroit. Ellis said Health and Human Services never meant to imply that workers shouldn't buy U.S.-made cars. And if they did, he's sorry. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. I mentioned I'm going to be filling the time today on the broadcast with some songs from my new CD, Songs Pointed and Pointless. Yes, it's for sale. Of course it is. And this one was sort of stirred up when it became known that President Bush was the world leader, or the American leader, in issuing signing statements. You remember how a bill becomes a law, Congress passes a law, President signs it or vetoes it. But this guy, and he didn't start it, but he is the now world leader in the practice, issues signing statements where he signs the bill into law, but says, but not really. The most famous case was last year when John McCain, before he started digging this war so good, came out against torture, presumably because he knew something about it. And so when the administration was saying, well, it was okay to do stuff that was sort of like torture if it didn't create the equivalent of gross organ damage, John McCain shepherded through Congress a bill saying, no, it's not okay to torture. And the president signed it, but issued a signing statement saying, but maybe it is. In other words, signing the bill while crossing his fingers.
Torture is torture no more. The ceiling is now on the floor. Oh, it's amazing what you can do if you don't mind the cost. Just as long as your fingers are crossed. The law is the law, so they say. It was true right up through today. No, you can't miss with a salad once it's been tossed. Listen, your fingers are crossed. When life tries to stand in your way and hostility lingers, just pretend to give in. Keep on crossing your fingers. Heard Johnny Cash do that in a song one time. A man's got to do what he can, or evil will succeed in its plan. My oath was that freedom will never be lost. Just remember, my fingers were crossed. When your troops are attacked by comics and writers and singers, it's the time when the strong and the true start crossing their fingers. Just finding the key there. Torture is torture no more. The ceiling is now on the floor. Oh, it's amazing what you can do if you don't mind the cost. Just as long as your fingers are crossed.
This is Le Show, and ladies and gentlemen, because it's important to feel safe when they're trying to make you feel safe, Britain's strategic nuclear warhead plant in Berkshire has suffered up to 1,000 safety defects in the last 5 years, according to figures obtained via that damn Freedom of Information Act. They got that over there now, too. The site builds bombs carried on the Trident missile submarines has only remained open because the government insisted it was vital to national security. It's only had 1,000 safety defects, but it's vital. News of the faults, 300 of which were still unrepaired in April of this year, are contained in 12 internal reports released by the Nuclear Installations Inspectorate, the NIE, the UK's Atomic Watchdog Agency. The NIE, that's appropriate. The NIE forced government scientists and engineers to suspend some operations at the facility on the grounds that there was a possible risk of radiation leaks, but it was overruled on others in the interests of maintaining the nuclear deterrent. Britain is deterring whom again? I forget. France? Many of the problems relate to radiation containment structures used when the warheads arrive by convoy from a depot near a naval base to be stripped down, tested, and reassembled. The warheads are then driven back north by road in heavily protected convoys to be reinstalled. Well, nothing could be wrong with that system. I feel safer already, just for having read that. And I knew about it before I read it. That's how I picked it out to read it for you. And even so, I feel safer. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm. See, it's defects. But you need it for the safety, for the deterrent. You see, is what I'm saying. Sorry, talking over the warm.
Listen to the warm.
Particles found in smoke plumes produced by cargo ships have been found to have a surprising cooling effect on the Earth's atmosphere. The results may alter predictions for climate change, although some experts note the effect is likely to be short-lived and outweighed by the release of carbon dioxide in the same plumes. They're plume mates. Shipping fuel is less refined than airplane fuel and contains more sulfur. As a result, tiny particles of sulfur dioxide contained in ship exhaust fumes create cloud tracks in the sky above a traveling vessel. Many of these can be seen from space. Now a team of German researchers has used satellite imagery to determine how the trails may be affecting global temperatures. This is from New Scientist. The particles provide a surface for moisture to condense on, forming droplets and ultimately clouds in the sky. These cloud tracks tend to form where there is already some cloud cover. Clear blue skies do not contain much moisture, so sulfur clouds form less easily. When sulfur is pumped into a cloudy sky, the clouds get denser. These clouds then reflect radiation from the sun back out into space, effectively cooling the area below. So, more shipping, please. But, on the other hand, Dateline Sydney. Global warming is occurring at a faster rate than the worst-case scenario envisaged by experts just 6 years ago. This according to Australia's top climate change scientist this very week. But he's just Australia's top. It's a small country. Tim Flannery named the 2007 Australian Man of the Year for his work in alerting the public to the dangers of global warming. He's kind of like their Al Gore. Said the issue was the greatest challenge facing humanity in the 21st century. He said predictions in a 2001 UN report warning the atmosphere was likely to warm by up to 5.8 degrees Celsius from 1990 to 2100 now appear conservative. Not as conservative as Pat Buchanan, but, you know, still. In the 6 years since then, we've collected enough data to check whether those predictions are valid or not. He says it turns out they're not valid in the most horrible way, because for the key performance indicators about climate change, change is occurring far in advance of the worst-case scenario, he said. Carbon dioxide's increasing more rapidly, sea levels are rising more rapidly, and the Arctic ice cap is melting away more quickly than were projected in 2001. Such good progress. We're doing something fast. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's dig in a little bit to news of the new Iraq. The flurry of early controversy about General Petraeus. I said Petraeus, not Petraeus, not Petraeus. And his view of how things are in Iraq has settled down. So let's look at some other indicators. Like the housing market. This from the Washington Post. Hundreds of thousands of Baghdad residents have fled their homes for the relative safety of segregated neighborhoods or foreign countries, so a clandestine system of buying and selling property off the books has supplanted more traditional real estate practices. If families being pushed out are lucky, they're able to sell their homes for a fraction of its previous price. Wait too long, and their houses might be seized at gunpoint. Real estate agent Mahir Al-Sultani says business has all but dried up. Ironic, he says, considering how many people are moving in and out. Without exception, half a dozen real estate agents contacted by the Post said houses are still being bought and sold, but licensed agents have largely been cut out of the equation. It all happens so quickly and in secret. What, says Sultani, what if the real estate agent is a militia member and you trust him with your money? Nobody trusts anybody, so they don't want a man in the middle. Immediately after the U.S.-led invasion in 2003, home prices in Baghdad skyrocketed, fueled by widespread expectations that the war would end quickly. They weren't spread this wide. And that foreign corporations would pour money into Iraq's economy. That's who's let us down, those foreign corporations. Can somebody get them on the phone, please? I'm busy. My dialing shoulder is sore. All my friends were asking me how to become a real estate agent, said one. Some weeks I was selling a home every day to people as investment properties. They thought when all the foreign investments came, Baghdad would be the new Dubai. But as the war dragged on, property values began a free fall that real estate agents say has not yet hit bottom. The wealthy families who returned to fancy homes in Baghdad left again for the stability of Jordan or Syria. Imagine that, the stability of Syria. That tells you something. That's the luxury of Pacoima. In many cases, leaving their house empty, lower and middle class people desperate to afford the high cost of emigrating rushed to sell their homes for any price. Altogether, according to the Iraqi Red Crescent, which is like the Red Cross, except maybe they actually deliver the aid, nearly a million people have been displaced from Baghdad. That's the new Iraq. A million people on their way out, forced to dump their homes. Another indicator? 10 days ago, General Petraeus's commanders in Baghdad began advertising for private contractors to work in combat supply warehouses on U.S. bases because half the soldiers who had been working in the warehouses were needed for protection of U.S. forces. So I guess security is good. Is that what that means? Here's another report. Security, this, by the way, is from the Pentagon. Report in the Washington Post, but it's a report from the Pentagon. Latest quarterly report on security in Iraq released this week by, just to repeat it one more time, the Pentagon. It says security is deteriorating in, well, it pronounces the word correctly, security is deteriorating in southern Iraq as rival Shiite militias vying for power have stepped up their attacks after moving out of Baghdad. The security environment in southern Iraq took a notable turn for the worse in August, says the Pentagon, with the assassination of two governors down there. There may be a retaliation and an increase in intra-Shia violence throughout the south, it said. This is the Pentagon saying this. It says Iran has intensified its training and funding of the Shiite militia. The growing violence in the south, according to the Pentagon, is one factor making it unlikely that Iraq's leaders will make headway this fall on key political resolutions, according to the Pentagon report. Did General Petraeus check with the Pentagon before he made his report? Quote, in the short term, Iraqi political leaders will likely be less concerned about reconciliation than with consolidating power and posturing for a future power struggle, said the Pentagon. I know, the Pentagon doesn't talk. You know what I mean. Casualties rose from about 130 killed or wounded on an average day in June to nearly 150 a day in July and August. That sounds like violence went up, but total monthly attacks went down. So you can cook those either way you like. Casualties went up, attacks went down. So they're getting more efficient. In another trend seen in earlier reports, attacks spread outside the Baghdad area, rising in neighboring provinces, Diyala and Salahuddin, where security remains, according to the Pentagon, fragile. Fragile is good, right? Violence and instability in some southern provinces reflects primarily the growing strength in the region of the Mahdi army, the militia of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, according to the Pentagon. The Pentagon assessment said the Mahdi army reasserted itself in one province after coalition forces there withdrew, illustrating how areas can revert to violence. According to the Pentagon, ladies and gentlemen. Who knew? Who knew the Pentagon hated freedom? The most ironic report of the week, though, came in the wake of the stories about Blackwater Security. You know about Blackwater, the private security firm that protects U.S. State Department personnel in Iraq. They were involved in a shooting incident last week. Prime Minister Maliki took off after them, rescinding their license to operate in the country, which apparently they don't need because they're still operating. After kicking them out and rescinding their license, Blackwater is in the country and is continuing to protect State Department personnel, which tells you all you need to know about Prime Minister Maliki. But about Blackwater, so apparently they don't, there are standards, ladies and gentlemen, for private contractors doing security duty in Iraq. Standards promulgated by, here's that word again, the Pentagon. But Blackwater doesn't, those standards don't apply to Blackwater because Blackwater works for the State Department. And the State Department has no combat standards because they're not a combat outfit. So Blackwater's free as a bird. But however, from the British newspaper The Guardian, this kooky little note on the once burgeoning world of private security in Iraq. They needed to be hired fast after the invasion. With too few U.S. soldiers on the ground, demand for private security guards was at a level not seen since the heyday of the Congo in the 1960s. Iraq was awash with billions of dollars from the U.S. and company profits soared, while those on the ground as private security contractors were earning much more than U.S.-British soldiers. But the boom is coming to an end, according to those in the trade. It will not be the same again, says Andy Bearpark, former director of operations for the Coalition Provisional Authority. That was the Paul Bremer operation. And now Director General of the recently formed British Association of Private Security Companies. Another colleague agrees. The $18 billion the U.S. paid out for Iraqi reconstruction will not be repeated, says Bearpark. And Richard Fenning, chief executive of Control Risks, echoes the point. Quote, "The situation has deteriorated. American money has dried up on reconstruction. It sounds counterintuitive," he continues, "but Iraq has got too dangerous for security companies to boom there." Iraq has got too dangerous for private security companies. Ladies and gentlemen, I say let's stay.
I was dancing in Bahrain. But the princes had their meeting, and they waved me goodbye. So now I'm flying commercial, a king off his throne. Help the children, but where are they now? Now that I need them.
Well, I know OJ needs a caddy. That part's true. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Le Show from the post-op lounge of the Le Show Dome. I'm probably back to normal next week, you know? Probably. I don't know. Jerry and Chevy may be right. But in the meantime, news from outside the bubble. On the subject of private security firms, this from the British newspaper The Independent. Private security chiefs warned that growing tensions between Iraqis and American armed bodyguards could descend into a disastrous shootout 4 months before Blackwater was suspended following the fierce gun battle that left 11 locals dead. A confidential memo sent to more than 200 private security companies in Iraq last May warned of the serious risk of armed exchanges between foreign guards and local security forces. From the Times of London, owned by Rupert Murdoch, on a totally different subject, a renewable energy source designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is contributing more to global warming than fossil fuels, a new study suggests. Measurements of emissions from the burning of biofuels derived from rapeseed and corn have been found to produce more greenhouse gas emissions than they save. Uh-oh. Look out, Mr. Ethanol. Other biofuels, especially those likely to see greater use over the next decade, perform better than fossil fuels, but the study raises serious questions about some of the most commonly produced varieties. Rapeseed and corn biodiesels were calculated to produce up to 70% and 50% more greenhouse gases, respectively, than oil. Concerns were raised over the levels of nitrous oxide, which is 296 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than CO2. Scientists found the use of biofuels released twice as much nitrous oxide as previously realized. Uh-oh. The research team found 3 to 5% of the nitrogen in fertilizer was converted and emitted. In contrast, the figure used by the International Panel on Climate Change was 2%. The findings illustrated the importance, say researchers, of ensuring that measures designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions are assessed thoroughly before being hailed as a solution. Did I say it was... Times of London was owned by Rupert Murdoch? Yeah. And there's more. British officials insist that persistent reports about U.S. military plans for an airstrike against Iran are being cooked up by Sunday newspaper journalists who can get retired generals and think tank people to say whatever they want. Sir David Manning is Britain's ambassador to Washington. He told the Times of London, owned by Rupert Murdoch still, that he had detected no sign from the U.S. administration at the moment that they are near to abandoning the diplomatic route. Maybe. Maybe not. And that's almost all of the news from outside the bubble, but evidence amassed by archaeologists, this is just rounding up one more item in a long-ago subject. Evidence amassed by archaeologists shows that even those Iraqis who trained as archaeological workers under Saddam's regime are now using their knowledge to join looters in digging through the ancient cities of Iraq, destroying thousands of priceless jars, bottles, and other artifacts in their search for treasure. In a long and devastating appraisal to be published in December, Lebanese archaeologist Joanne Farshach says armies of looters have spared not 1 meter of the Sumerian capitals that have been buried under the sand for thousands of years. They've systematically destroyed the remains of this civilization in their tireless search for sellable artifacts, ancient cities covering an estimated surface area of 20 square kilometers, which could have provided extensive new information concerning the development of the human race. I think we know enough about that, don't you? I think we know where that's going. Quote, humankind is losing its past. For a tablet or a sculpture, a piece of jewelry that the dealer buys and pays for in cash in a country devastated by war. Humankind is losing its history for the pleasure of private collectors living safely in their luxurious houses and ordering specific objects for their collection. Ms. Farshach, who helped with the original investigation into stolen treasures from the Baghdad Archaeological Museum, says Iraq may soon end up with no history. Well, then we really have succeeded in Americanizing it, haven't we? Quote, there are 10,000 archaeological sites in the country. They have all been systematically looted. Even when Alexander the Great destroyed a city, she says, he would always build another. But now the robbers are destroying everything because they're going down to bedrock. What's new is the looters are becoming more and more organized with apparently lots of money. Quite apart from this, she adds, military operations are damaging these sites forever. There's been a U.S. base in Ur for 5 years, and the walls are cracking because of the weight of military vehicles. It's like putting an archaeological site under a continuous earthquake. Ur, of course, regarded as the most important ancient city of mankind, mentioned in the Old Testament, believed by many to be the home of Prophet Abraham. But it's old. It's history. That's so un-American. They'll be grateful one of these days. And now, ladies and gentlemen, finally from my CD, the song I was allowed to do on the Jimmy Kimmel Live show this week.
New York is my lady. Ooh, too long we've been apart. Her tunnels of love are calling. Her bridges are burning my heart. I'm gonna go back to my lady. She's calling wherever I roam. You know that New York is my lady. And my lady is my home, sweet home. Yeah, New York is my lady. Oh, she charms me day and night. Her Bronx shows such pleasing cleavage. Her Brooklyn is clean out of sight. Her Queens is too classy for royalty. Staten Island, a trip across that foam. You know that New York is my lady. And my lady's my home, sweet home. Now, wait a minute. I've been unfaithful to her. Yeah, I've spent time with other dames. But just hearing her name set my heart aflame. I've got a yen just to see her again. I've got an itch for that fabulous witch. Oh, New York is my lady. And my lady, she is no tram. Her Central Park is a ball after dark. Her streets are no place to camp. You've got to acknowledge my lady. She's a beauty without brush or comb. You know that New York is my lady. And my lady's my home, sweet. I got to repeat, my lady's my home, sweet.
Of course, it's not. That's the point. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this edition of Le Show from the post-op lounge of the Le Show Dome. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ The Planet. On the mighty 104 in Berlin, on Sirius and XM satellite radio networks, around the world via the internet, on your computer at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available as a free download at www.audible.com/theshow. Available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like regaining full range of motion if you'd agree with them, would you? All righty, thank you very much. And if you can't live without me till next Sunday, check out www.mydamnchannel.com, where the second internet silent presidential debate debuts this Tuesday. HarryShear.com is the place for the email address for this broadcast, as well as for playlists of the music heard on this program. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks, and to Judith Owen and Pam Halstead. So comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.